In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Spring has sprung in Iowa, and there are all kinds of colorful and vibrant words and phrases that come along with it. This hour, we will explore the language of spring with Patricia O'Connor, author of Woe Is I, The Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English, and other books about the English language. She blogs at grammarphobia.com, as she is with me on the line now. Hello, Pat.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. It's so nice to hear your voice again. It's been a while.
And it has.
I was thinking about language this morning with the anniversary of the day that the World Health Organization announced that COVID-19 had reached the point of being a pandemic. I was thinking back to how 1 year ago we were spending all of this time parsing our language and trying to explain what pandemic meant. And boy, things have changed a lot in a year.
Right. Now everybody pretty much knows what it means.
That's true. It'll be a long time before we forget.
Right.
Let's talk about...
But you're going to reach the 50. I hear that Iowa City is going to get up into the 50s today.
It's true. Although it has been warmer. We're actually having kind of a gloomy, cooler day today. But still, we've had so much snow melt. We had a lot of sunshine early in the week. The ground is pretty much bare. We had a lovely spring shower overnight last night. It definitely feels like spring out there.
Yeah, spring shower. That's a phrase that... that was actually dates from the 1600s, spring shower. It means a rain shower happening in the spring. And it's usually spring showers are welcome because of all the emerging shoots and newly planted seeds. But well, you see, we're still using phrases that were used 500 years ago.
And a lot of them, actually. I mean, spring itself, obviously we have our names for the seasons. Do we know where spring comes from?
Yes, actually, spring is a really good example of how language develops because it wasn't originally the word for a season. Spring originally, back in around the year 900, was a verb for describing what liquids do when they suddenly rise or leap or spill, as in, it's a little gory, but as blood might run from a wound. It was a gory time back then. It came to be associated with water rising up out of the ground, and this is how the noun spring came to mean a place where water issues from the earth, and it later came to mean a stream or a brook. Meanwhile, a new sense of the word spring was developing, and a spring began to mean an emerging, a rising, a new beginning. And to spring meant to leap or jump or come into being. So this is when people started calling sunrise or dawn the spring of the day. Hmm. And the waxing or the increasing size of the moon was called the spring of the moon. They also began calling the time of year when leaves emerge from their buds the spring of the leaf. In other words, the emerging of the leaf. And similarly, at the other end of the calendar, the time when leaves began falling from trees was called the fall of the leaf. And soon these two phrases, spring of the leaf for the growing season and fall of the leaf for the harvest season, were just shortened to spring and fall. So the names of those two seasons, spring and fall, are unusual in that they actually evolved within English. We didn't inherit them from any other languages. And they had a literal flavor originally, one a leaping up, the other a dropping down.
That's so interesting.
I think that's rather poetic.
It is poetic. And I can't imagine any other name for spring. It's kind of extra cool that it evolved organically like that.
It is extra cool. And there was a time when, very briefly, when English had Latin names for all of the seasons. But those did not take hold like spring and fall. The only Latin word for a season we've kept is autumn, from the Latin autumnus. And the British have stopped using fall. They stopped using it toward the end of the 18th century and just kept autumn. But Americans kept both words, spring, which was an Anglo-Saxon development, I'm sorry, fall, which was an Anglo-Saxon development, and autumn. We got the name, English got the names for summer and winter directly from Germanic.
Interesting.
Summer and winter. Yes.
Summer and winter are less evocative than spring and fall. I think that those win. Well, and you had mentioned spring showers. Of course, adding spring to any word seems kind of like a natural thing that follows once you have
it
the name spring.
It didn't always mean the season. Sometimes it meant something new or something green, as in, for example, the phrase spring roll, which we order at a Chinese restaurant, the appetizer, it's all or mostly vegetables, and that's why it's called spring roll. Now, it got its name in the early 20th century from a Chinese chef who literally translated the Chinese term chun juan into English. In Chinese, chun juan is a compound. The chun part means spring, with connotations of newness, freshness, and greenness. And juan means to roll up. And it actually appeared first in a Chinese cookbook written in English in the 20s by a Chinese chef. And it's mainly vegetables rolled up in a wrapper, a pancake-like or crepe-like wrapper, and deep-fried.
Well,
I apologize to any Chinese speakers out there for massacring the pronunciation.
Feel free to call in and tell us exactly how to say it if you'd like. That meaning of green, that's something that we see in a lot of different places then, too. If we think of spring greens, you know, or a spring mix for your salad, which, of course, can be grown in the spring or the fall or in a greenhouse any time of year.
Yes, and actually there are a lot of greenish terms like that were first recorded in writing in the 1700s. Spring green as a description of a light green color. And spring greens, the young leaves of spring vegetables, and a spring onion, which is a little onion like a scallion that either doesn't form a big bulb or is picked when it's young, too young for the bulb to develop. And also spring soup was the name of a soup for a soup or stew that was made of fresh green vegetables. Those are all from the 1700s.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about spring cleaning, something that is on my to-do list. When did we start talking about that?
Yeah, spring cleaning is a phrase that was first recorded in Massachusetts in the 1840s, and it means just a very thorough house cleaning. And because it was traditionally done at the beginning of the year, or springtime, that's why it was called spring cleaning. But I imagine the previous winter had something to do with it, because houses must have gotten kind of sooty and dirty during the winter in those days, as they still do.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think that's really gotten any different. Although when you have dogs, spring cleaning kind of has to wait until spring has really sprung, or you've just got a lot of mud in your house.
Right.
Spring break is something, of course, a lot of us are anticipating, although for most of us, it'll be another staycation this year. When did that occur?
Well, spring break to mean a vacation, specifically from university or college, was first recorded in the mid-1950s. But there was an earlier phrase that might have influenced it, spring term. Now, that had meant a spring session in the American court system since the 1700s. And it had been used at universities to mean the academic session, since the early 1900s. So there were predecessor usages for spring break.
Spring training, of course, something that that a lot of people
spring training,
engage in.
We now think of it as baseball.
Yeah.
In fact, down here in Sarasota, the Orioles do their spring training down here. But it was used originally, spring training, in the 1820s to refer to the training of racehorses. They would do their spring training, I guess, before the racehorse racing season began.
Again, probably you had to wait until the mud had passed a little bit to be able to do
that. Now, another old one, spring fever. It has had two different meanings. Originally, in the late 1600s, a spring fever was actually a fever, an illness occurring in the spring like a flu. But later in the 19th century, it came to mean an emotional state associated with spring, restlessness, excitement, romance, the jitters, you know, all those sorts of things, needing to get out of the house.
Interesting. I think it has a positive connotation for the most part now. So it really shifted from a negative to a positive.
Yes, definitely.
Now, a spring chicken is something very specific.
Yes. Now, again, that one also was adapted from an earlier term that was more literal. Originally, in the 18th century, a spring chicken was a small chicken, especially one suited for eating, rather than egg laying, or one that's available in the spring. But 19th century Americans began using it more colloquially or casually to refer to a young person. And then later in the 20th century, this was used in the negative to describe somebody who's no longer young, as in she's no spring chicken.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard it used to actually describe a young person,
opposite. It's not really used in a positive term. You don't hear someone say, he's a spring chicken. It's usually, he's not a spring chicken.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're exploring the language of spring and some related language as well this hour with Patricia O'Connor, author of Woe Is I, The Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English and other books about the English language. She blogs at grammarphobia.com, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions or your comments. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
The way you get your news may have changed during this pandemic, but you still need to know what's going on in our state every day. Iowa Public Radio News has you covered. Subscribe to our new podcast, Hear First, and start your day equipped with the essential local news you need to know, delivered in under 15 minutes, weekdays by 7 a.m. Get analysis from IPR's team of reporters, learn about what's going on at the Statehouse and on the ground in your community. Subscribe to Hear First today wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are exploring the language of spring with our English language expert, Patricia O'Connor. She's the author of Woe Is I and other books about the English language, and she blogs at grammarphobia.com. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions about the language of spring, but about the English language in general. You can also share your pet peeves as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Patricia, we have an email from Mark, and he wants to talk about another meaning for spring and how we use it. He was wondering where the phrases spring for the bill at a restaurant and spring someone from prison came from.
Well, spring someone from prison, that is a slang use based on an old use of spring just meaning to release or to leap out. So that's where that one comes from. Spring for the bill, that one I'm not quite sure of. I'm just taking a peek here if I can see quickly. Let's see.
It's such an evocative phrase. You can just imagine someone reaching
spring
across the table.
Bill. I think it's going to take too long to find this, but I think I would guess that it probably means to jump for something. I'll jump and grab it. You know, that sort of thing. It seems like a natural sort of slang used to evolve.
Yeah, well, and something else that we use that's coming up this weekend, it'll be time to spring forward time-wise. And that's kind of a mnemonic device, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And of course, is from the 20th century when daylight savings was introduced. And the phrase was spring forward, fall back, to help people remember which direction they set their clocks in. And the earliest use that I found for this is from 1936, although I can't understand why there aren't earlier ones. If I looked further into further old databases, I might find one. But the earliest one that I found so far is from a newspaper in Brooklyn, New York. And it said, the headline, we've all seen this since then so many times, headline, remember to put clocks back, and remember to put clocks hour ahead on retiring. And the text said, turn your timepieces ahead at 2 a.m. tomorrow when daylight saving time goes into effect. Spring forward, fall back is the way to remember the direction. So we've been using that ever since. It's the only way I can remember it.
Right. Well, and if you go the opposite direction, you're in real trouble.
Yeah, you're 2 hours off.
Right. And you were I noticed that you were very careful to say daylight saving time, as opposed to daylight savings, which we often do here.
Yes. It's said both ways. I was just actually reading what that 1936 newspaper said, daylight saving time. And it was the original phrase, daylight saving time.
Well, we have some more.
It's from 1908, believe it or not.
Interesting. So we have more spring language, and we're going to talk about some of the names of flowers as well here in just a moment. But we do have a couple of calls on the line on other topics. So we'll turn now to Claudia in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Claudia.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, you know, people feel some passion in the spring, and they feel passionately about it. I listen to the radio, public radio and public TV a lot. When they talk about public TV, they always say people feel passionate about it instead of feeling passionately about it. And I was wondering if I could get clarification on passionate versus feeling passionately.
It sounds like a little bit of festival fatigue as well right now, Claudia.
Yeah, but there you go.
But thank you for watching and for listening. What do you think, passionate versus passionately?
Well, actually, the correct word would be passionate, to feel passionate. And the reason is that feel is a linking verb. It doesn't mean to touch with your fingers. If you said, I'm touching this passionately, you meant you were touching it in a passionate way, feeling. But this feeling is a linking verb, and it means it's a condition or a state, like the verb to be. I am passionate. So with a linking verb like feel or seem or appear, or B, we use the adjective passionate rather than the adverb passionately.
So
with a linking verb, you use an adjective.
So when we say that someone feels passionately, is that wrong?
Well, I don't like saying things are wrong, but it wouldn't be the standard usage, no.
Okay. All right.
You wouldn't say, I am passionately. Or he seems passionately. You say he seems passionate. He is passionate. He feels passionate. Feel is a copula verb. It's not an action verb.
But that's definitely one of those words that is a living, evolving part of our language. I mean, we certainly hear it both ways a lot.
Yes. Yeah.
Claudia, thank you so much for bringing that up. What an interesting question. James is on the line next in Iowa City at 866-780-9100. Hello, James.
Hi, Patricia. My question is about the use of prairie versus plain. I think people use the word prairie when they should be using plain, prairie being having to do with organic matter, biological things, whereas plain is geophysical.
Hmm. Well, I agree with you. Plain is more of a geological word. It's a kind of landscape, whereas prairie, to me, seems to indicate more the kind of horticultural conditions there. Now, I'm not an expert on either geology or horticulture.
Well, and James, I think
I may be wrong about that, but I tend to agree with you on that.
I'm just going to offer that when we talk about the prairie state or, you know, this part of the country, mm-hmm. maybe that's mm-hmm. a little more poetic, more evocative than talking
it
about
the plains.
It is
more poetic
plains,
and evocative.
Although,
if you said the plain state, plains just, it's a geographical description.
Yeah, and prairie is a French word meaning meadow.
Mm. Yes, it does. It does yeah. evoke the notion of a meadow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I would agree with you there.
Okay.
An uninformed opinion, however, I should add. That's uninformed on my part.
Oh, James, thank you so much for the call. And we do have to take some poetic license every now and again.
Yes. I want to mention one thing about green. Green is a really such an interesting word. It's extremely, extremely old. It's in the earliest recorded Old English writing inherited from Germanic. And it's the color most identified with spring. And we aren't alone in this because the word for spring in Italian and in Spanish, same word, primavera, I think it's one of the prettiest words in any language, and it means first green. But in English, as well as in other cultures, the color green has also been associated with youthfulness, freshness, naivete. When we say someone's green, we mean new or experienced or innocent, unpracticed. And an interesting example of this is the word greenhorn. Now, as I've often said that a lot of these terms once had literal meanings and then evolved to mean other things. And the same is true of greenhorn. Originally, in the 1400s, a greenhorn was a young ox, with new horns just budding out. And since the late 18th century, greenhorn has been used to mean a naive or inexperienced person, like a young ox. And when, you know, we think of green salads, too, when Shakespeare coined the expression salad days, he was making a pun on the word green. The line from Antony and Cleopatra is, "My salad days, when I was green in judgment." Now, although Shakespeare used it to mean salad days to mean a time of youthful inexperience, we use it very differently today. Now, salad days means a person's prime or heyday, a peak of success, which is pretty much the opposite from the early salad days, which meant the time when I had no idea what I was doing. I was so green. So I thought that was kind of an interesting evolution there.
Right. Well, and I've wondered when people use salad days to mean sort of the peak of somebody's career, I've wondered if they're talking about money as opposed to vegetables.
Well, that's included. That's part of it. It means your prime, the heyday when you were making money, when you knew what you were doing, when you were in charge, that kind of thing.
I'm still waiting.
So it also includes financial financial angle there.
We have a question from Mary in Des Moines. She says, "I hear/read the awkward phrase push back against constantly. No one resists mm-hmm. or disagrees or refutes anymore." That is certainly a phrase that is of the moment. It's something mm-hmm. we hear a lot.
It is push back, and you know, sometime I'd like to talk about words that are used a lot in the office. corporate jargon and office jargon, and that's become one of them. When, you know, if you work in an office, you'll hear this a lot. You won't say resist or object or something. You'll say, I want to push back on that a little.
Yes, and see, then I want to drill down on it. I want to reach out to somebody. We're going to utilize this. Oh, yes. We definitely need to do that show, Pat. That sounds like a lot of fun.
We need to do that. But pushback is one of those. It's just another word for resist or object to, but it makes you sound like you're not being quite so obnoxious. See, it sounds like you're being more forceful.
Right. You don't want to offend anyone, but I'm just going to gently bring up a couple of objections. All right, let's go back to the phones. Russ is on the line in Alexander. Hi, Russ.
Hello. Yes.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I just would like to hear your comments and critique about some of those overused phrases in common vernacular. One thing I hear all the time is someone perhaps is being interviewed by someone else on the radio or television, and they're asked a question, and they start with, so, here's what I did.
That, you know,
so,
I have to tell you, that is when my husband and I started writing our blog, I think it was 2006. Anyway, that was one of the first questions we were asked. And it still comes up every couple of months. Somebody will write to ask us that. And there's nothing grammatically wrong with that. It's just starting a sentence with a conjunction, and there really is nothing wrong with a conjunction. As I've said a lot of times, we start sentences with but or and, meanwhile. Those are conjunctions. So is a way of a way of introducing what you want to say without really having an introduction. It's a weak kind of segue.
Well, and
there's nothing wrong with it, but it is a little bit weak, and it becomes a verbal tick.
Right.
And
I was
hear
just going to say
it
that,
on
Pat.
Interviews.
It becomes
a verbal tick.
It's a way to stall. It's a little bit of a time filler. And, of course, I'm guilty of using it myself. But there are...
Because you can also drag it out.
Right.
It's not just so, you know, so... It's so. So you can get your thoughts together before you answer.
Yes, there. I could make you a long list of things that people say when they are not quite ready to answer a question, including, that's a great question.
Right. What a good question. I'm so glad you brought that up.
Right. You've just bought yourself 4 seconds to think. Right. So Russ, that absolutely is something that we hear a lot. And,
and
you know, once you tune into one of those things, then you hear it all the time, and then it starts to drive you crazy.
And it's a very old usage, by the way.
Oh,
it's not new. But often when people start to notice something, they think it's new. And that there's a name for that in linguistics. It's called the recency illusion. You think it just popped up, but actually people have been doing it for, you know, generations, and you just noticed it, so you think it's new.
And if you're listening for it, you'll hear it far more often than you ever did before.
It's like there's another phenomenon like that. Say you buy a car. Say you buy a Subaru Outback. You've never had one before. You start noticing them, and you think, my gosh, everybody's got a Subaru Outback. It's not really true. It's just that you are starting to notice Subaru Outbacks. So you think everyone has one and that they're everywhere. They're no more common than they ever were.
Yeah. There are
Not
so
that
many
I have
examples
anything
of
against
that.
Subaru. you could substitute any make of car you want.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Will is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Will.
Hi,
what would you like to talk about?
I've got a question on a common saying that I didn't really hear it much when I was younger, but when I was going to college, it came up all the time, and that's when someone would ask a question, they'd say, logical sense, like, does this make logical sense? Mm-hmm. And my argument was always, if it's logical, shouldn't it make sense? Do we have to use both? Can we just say this is logical? but it just, they say logical sense all the time, and it drives me nuts.
It does sound a little redundant. What do you think, Pat?
It's just a little redundancy. There's nothing wrong with redundancy, grammatically speaking. Stylistically, it can be kind of boring, but a lot of people use redundancy, I think legitimately, for emphasis. For instance, chase after. You don't have to put after in there, but it adds a little oomph. It adds a little emphasis. And there's nothing wrong with a little emphatic redundancy. But I think logical sense, better to say, is it logical? Does it make sense? You know?
Yeah, I'm with you on that one, Will.
I think people are going to notice that kind of redundancy.
We are going to take...
I would like to talk about some flowers, by the way.
Let's do that when we get back from a break. How does that sound?
Yes, let's do.
All right. With me today, Patricia O'Connor, author of Woe Is I, The Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English and other books. She blogs at grammarphobia.com, and we are talking about the language of spring. She's also here to answer any of your questions about the English language. You can share your pet peeves as well. Give us a call, 866-780-9000. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
The legislative session is scheduled for 110 days. There will be hundreds of bills proposed this year.
I would like to call the subcommittee meeting to order.
From subcommittees to committees.
I really want to support this bill.
To the chamber floor.
Every senator has voted. The secretary will close the voting system.
Our weekly podcast, Under the Golden Dome, walks you through the legislative process. I'm John Pimple. Subscribe to Under the Golden Dome with your podcast listening program or hear it at iowapublicradio.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, Patricia O'Connor is here, author of Woe Is I, The Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English and Plain English, and other books. She also blogs at grammarphobia.com. We've been talking about the language of spring, but of course you can join the conversation with your questions about the English language or the language of spring at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Patricia, let's talk about flowers, which of course is one of the things we most look forward to in the spring.
Oh, right. I hear through the grapevine that snowdrops are already appearing in Iowa City and crocuses. Snowdrop is an interesting word. Now, in the earlier Germanic languages, this flower was called both a snowdrop and a snowbell. In Swedish and in German, for example, they have both words. They have snowdrop and snowbell. English just adopted snowdrop in the 1600s, probably because we already had the words bluebell from the earlier century. So snowdrop, very old, 1600s. Crocus, now this has an interesting history. It comes from the Greek word for saffron, which is almost identical, crocos. And when crocus was first used in English in the Middle Ages, it meant saffron. It didn't mean the flower until the 16th century. Now, there are dozens of crocus species, but only one of them, the fall-blooming Crocus sativus, produces saffron. It's those little stigma that stick out, and they are dark orangish, yellow. Those dried stigma are what saffron is made of. Now, the Greeks probably got crocos from a similar word in Hebrew or Aramaic, but the word can be traced ultimately back to Sanskrit, a very ancient complex of beautiful language, Sanskrit. A tulip is another one that came into Western Europe from the East. It was the Turks who introduced the tulip plant to Western Europe in the 16th century. And because the Turks thought the open flower of a tulip resembled a turban, they gave it the Turkish name for a turban, which was tuliband. This came into English as tulipa, ending in A, tulipa. and it later evolved into tulip. And by the way, the Turks got their name for a turban from the Persian word for a turban, which was dulband. So this Persian word, dulband, is the source of both English words, tulip and turban.
Interesting.
And daffodil, that's another early bloomer.
Yes, we're eagerly awaiting them. And I have seen the green of some daffodils up.
You have?
Yeah.
Oh, that's really good news. The original word from about 1400 was affodil. It started with an A. It was affodil. But in the middle of the 1500s, a D was added to the front. No one quite knows why. It may be because it had been used with an article before it, and it was just easier to put the D on. But anyway, the fact that two words then existed, affodil and daffodil, enabled English to distinguish between two different flowers. The affodil was a lily that eventually got the name asphodel, and the daffodil was the name used for the familiar yellow plant that had been called a narcissus. We still call it a narcissus. The phrase, by the way, the phrase Daffy Down Dilly, a comic phrase used in Old English nursery rhymes, it was an expansion of the word daffodil, Daffy Down Dilly.
I think daffodil
sounds
like much more fun.
But the words daffy and daff aren't related.
That's good. Yeah. Oh, very interesting.
Yeah, those come from daft. That's a totally different word.
we have some more questions here that I want to get to, and we can talk a little bit more about some of the plant words that are associated with spring. But Ruth in Ames has a spring-related term question. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, Charity.
Hi. What's your question today?
Well, I was very interested in the alternative word for the season of fall and where it came from. But nothing was said about an alternative word for spring as related to the spring season. Now, what comes to my mind is the phrase vernal equinox, referring to the equinox in the spring, the first night of spring. So that would be the counterpart to the autumnal equinox. Mm-hmm. So where does vernal come from?
It comes from Latin. We still use the adjective vernal for the adjectival form for spring. That comes from Latin. And in the Romance languages, they still use Latin derivatives for all the seasons, in fact, but you can hear it in spring, like primavera, verano. Verano is summer in Spanish, and ver was the Latin spring. The Latin word for spring was ver, or tempus vernum, and actually, the French, I take it back, the French do not use the vernal derivatives for spring. They use printemps, which means, it's from Latin, it means primus, first, and tempus, time. So it means first time, the French word for spring, printemps, because it was considered the first season of the year.
Interesting.
We still use the adjective vernal, but we do not any longer use the Latin derivative for spring. By the way, Herbst, we don't use the German word for autumn. We use the Latin. The German word for autumn, Herbst, has the same ancestry as our word harvest. That's for fall.
Well, that's lovely.
And Freudling, the German word for spring, is from Freu, meaning early, because spring was considered the earliest season.
Very interesting. Let's talk about a couple of other flower and plant names, and then we'll do a couple more questions here before we run out of time. We didn't quite get to forsythia before.
Oh, forsythia. Yeah, this is a plant named after a person, which is quite common in botanical naming. Forsythia was named for a Scottish botanist named William Forsyth. He died in 1804. And the forsythia, which was newly classified in 1805, was named in his honor. The forsythia for William Forsyth. Forsythia was a Latinization of his last name, which is a common practice in botanical taxonomy, the naming of plants. William Forsyth, by the way, very interesting man, very, very famous in his time. He was superintendent of gardens for several of the English royal palaces.
Oh, interesting.
So if you wanted to know what to do for your ailing geranium, you went to William Forsyth.
He was a busy man.
Yeah, he was busy.
It's time to start seeds this time of year. What about the word seed?
Yes. Seed, well, it has a very interesting and old history, as you might imagine. It's been known in English writing since the 800s. Now, it was inherited from Germanic seed, and it has a diminutive form, seedling, which the ling suffix there, ling, is a diminutive. It means little. And we also see this in seedling, sapling. The diminutives act as in to mean a small something, as in we see it also princeling, duckling, gosling. Those are all diminutive forms. Oh, speaking of diminutive, here's another plant notion. A seed is a little kernel of something that grows into a plant. Now, kernel is a diminutive word. It is a diminutive of the word corn. I've talked about corn on Talk of Iowa before. As far back as the 600s, really far back in English, the noun corn meant a small, hard particle, like a grain of sand or a little nugget of salt. This is why corned beef means beef cured in coarse grains or corns of salt. But besides a hard particle, corn also meant a grain or a seed. And the word kernel is a diminutive of that word. So a kernel is a small corn. You might say it's like a cornling.
So, nice.
Yes, and at one time there was an expression, kernel fruit. Back in the 17th and 18th centuries, people referred to apples as kernel fruit and pears as kernel fruit because they had lots of seeds, as opposed to a stone fruit, which had a single large stone or pit, like a peach. So there was kernel fruit on one hand, stone fruit on the other.
Let's get back to the phones. Shane is on the line in Conrad. Hi, Shane.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
So I mentioned this phrase to a colleague a while back, and they'd never heard of it, thought it was hilarious. But can you tell me where the origination of a fly in the ointment comes from?
Oh, fly in the ointment. I don't know when it was first recorded. I can look that up here. But it means a complication in the situation, as in a fly has landed in the ointment, literally. I'm guessing it's 19th century U.S., but I could be wrong. Here, I'm looking it up.
Well, and I can imagine that, you know, I think about the use of ointment on farms with farm animals. I can imagine that flies would get in the ointment quite a lot. And that's one of those kind of annoying things.
Yeah. Oh,
that
here I
just
find
generalized.
Here I find there's a use from Charles Lamb in the 1820s. So I'm wrong about it being American. Charles Lamb was British. And he said, a poor relation is the most irrelevant thing in nature. A lion in your path, a frog in your chamber, a fly in your ointment.
A frog in your chamber has not caught
a frog
on
in
and
your
stuck
chamber.
Around like the fly in the ointment did.
I know.
But Shane,
you know,
you should use that
in
your with
chamber
your coworker.
That may sound weird, but I've actually had frogs in the house. If you live in Florida, they can get in. So it's not so unusual. I have my little net that I run around with to catch if I see a frog in the house.
Oh, very funny. All right. Here you get an opportunity to settle a marital dispute from Tim in Ames. He says, my wife and me / my wife and I have a dispute as to which is correct in usage. Joe and me went to or Joe and I went to. Which one is correct?
Joe and I, because you're speaking as, this is what you should do. If you can't figure that one out, just eliminate the Joe part. Reduce it to the I or me pronoun. I went. If it's the subject, it's I. But if it's the object, it's me. As you say, you can't tell that to Joe and me. You can't tell that to me. So just eliminate the other guy. That's how to figure that one out.
And I don't know whether that means Tim won or his wife won, but we hope that you'll resolve that kindly. This is just a comment from Angelica in Des Moines. She says, I just wanted to add to the conversation about starting a sentence with so, that Seamus Heaney's translation of Beowulf begins with so. So that's good enough for me.
Yes.
We all have those little touchstones that help us out here. Let's try to slip in one more call here. Travis is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Travis.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question just kind of about your thoughts and feedback on kind of words that are used as exclamations at the end of sentences. So I notice a lot in TV and radio interviews, when somebody makes a point or states a fact, they'll often say, right at the end of the sentence is kind of a question, but an exclamation. And it's a pet peeve of mine, and it distracts from the point, in my opinion. But I was just curious about your thoughts about kind of those verbal ticks and exclamations.
Oh, okay. Well, that's actually a question, putting a question at the end of a sentence. You make a statement, and you add the question right at the end of it, because you're insecure about whether you're correct or not, or you want approval, or you want some sort of approbation. So it reflects a little bit of insecurity. There's nothing grammatically wrong with that. It's like saying, now your birthday is next Tuesday, correct? You know, that wouldn't bother you, would it?
I put Travis back on hold.
Yeah, you wouldn't be bothered with that.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So the addition of right or any other question like that at the end of a statement isn't incorrect. It just reflects the speaker's not quite sure and wants confirmation.
However, I think it's also used just in popular usage right now. There's the phrase, I know, right? That is, you know, we even have an acronym for it. You type it into your...
I guess I don't converse with enough teenagers often enough to hear that a lot.
Right. Well, I do converse with a lot of teenagers.
Unnecessary.
Right.
But but again, not wrong.
I think it's just to get a rise out of somebody or to create that sense of companionship or community that we both feel the same way.
You want confirmation either from somebody that you're telling something to or from your peer group. You want their agreement or their approval.
Right. It also gives you something to say back if you're having a text message conversation and you don't really have anything else to say.
Right.
I know, right?
As I just did. You know, you and I have been saying right an awful lot.
Right.
Right?
Oh, Patricia, the hour has flown by, but thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Patricia O'Connor, she is the author of Woe Is I, The Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English and other books about the English language. She blogs at grammarphobia.com, so you can get a whole lot more of this if you go to grammarphobia.com. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio, and we've got our March Book Club coming up soon on March 23rd. We'll be talking about The Overstory by Richard Powers. You still have time to read the book and join the conversation. You can also join our group on Facebook. Search for IPR's Talk of Iowa Book Club and join a community of book lovers. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.